welcome to the Fretboard Journal Podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde, and as always, our music is by the one and only John Rauhaus. As you probably know from listening to this podcast or picking up the Fretboard Journal print magazine, I like to keep you all on your toes. We are probably to a fault eclectic, but I love nothing better than turning you all on to guitar stories you're not going to find anywhere else. Case in point is this week's guest, my friend Todd Nelson. Todd has nothing to promote, no new album, no great guitar he built that he's trying to sell to you. He's just one of us, and he's led a fascinating life, and I want you to meet him. A little backstory is probably in order. I met Todd in 1998 when I moved to Seattle from California, knowing absolutely no one up here. I took a job for a website called Amazon.com. Maybe you've heard of it. It was my first big grown-up move. At the time, Amazon was selling books, but they were about to start selling CDs for the first time. They hired a bunch of music writers and editors and industry types from around the world. And amongst that cast of characters trying to invent an online music store from scratch, whatever that is, Todd was the veteran among us. He was one of the first 10 employees at Amazon. He knew everybody. He had the cool desk with the vintage Gibson Electric sitting right next to his computer. There were punk rock and indie posters on the wall. And Todd had this big smile and swagger that only comes from working at a company long enough that he knows where all the bodies are buried. While the rest of us were awkward geeks trying to learn new computer systems in a new city and figure out our new jobs, Todd was just having fun and pointing us in the right direction. Fast forward many years. Todd eventually leaves Amazon. He settles down. He starts a family. He has a super sweet wife and a daughter, and they now live outside of San Luis Obispo, California. You're probably wondering where this story is headed. Trust me, it's a good one. Connected through social media, I've watched Todd have a series of seemingly impossibly difficult health issues. You're going to get the full recap. But throughout it all, Todd has had this incredible upbeat attitude, and he's remained one of the most passionate guitar and music lovers around. He recently undertook something he's dubbing a song a day for acoustic guitar. He's basically teaching himself one song a day. He's got a growing Spotify playlist of the songs that he's tackling. And if you want to check it out, I'll include a link in the show notes. And if you're so inclined, he's taking suggestions for music you think he might love. And you can email me those at podcast@fretboardjournal.com, and I will compile a list for him. Now, when Todd first posted about this project, I thought it might make for a fun, short podcast, but I had no idea just how deep we'd go or how important the guitar has been with him through this whole ordeal. So I hope you enjoy this candid conversation between two old friends and coworkers, and I hope you enjoy hearing Todd's story. We have three sponsors for this episode: Folkway Music up in Canada, Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York City, and Mono Cases. Please remind all those brands that you appreciate them sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. And our 48th issue of the journal is out now, so please go get it. It powers all that we do, and keep sharing this podcast with your friends. It's all simple stuff that keeps our show growing. Now, with that lengthy buildup, here's my conversation with my old friend, Todd Nelson. Todd Nelson, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Well, Jason, I'm honored to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I don't know if you really wanted to be on, but I insisted that you appear on the show, and so here you are. I want to give folks a little bit of context before we get into, you know, where you're at today and the reason that I wanted you to be on the show. You have a place in .com history, which we will eventually get into, and our paths crossed at that place. But, you know, why don't you tell folks where you grew up and maybe when, like, playing music entered your life?
I grew up a GE brat, so moved all over the country with my family. I had very young parents. My dad was a really talented and gifted guitar player. He was self-taught. He bought a little cheap, made in Mexico guitar. Well, actually, he was in Mexico and he bought a guitar. And he started playing songs by ear, and he was really talented. So I grew up with him singing Everly Brothers, you know, Elvis, Buddy Holly, Kinks, a lot of old standards like Scotch and Soda and things like that. So it was always a part of my upbringing, was, you know, hearing someone play guitar. So naturally I gravitated towards guitar. the funny thing about my dad is that his ear was so fickle that he would put notes and chords in places that they were never actually in the song. So his songs were very complicated. So like at one point I was trying to learn the Kinks, You Really Got Me. And my dad's playing like 15 chords. And I'm like, Dad, I think this is just three chords. And he's like, no, he's adding sevenths and ninths and minors. I quickly sort of rebelled against that. And, you know, right around the age of 15 or 16, discovered punk rock and learned my three chords. And pretty much that was it for me. Yeah. So I never really developed as a guitarist for a long time. But I immediately started a band. Playing covers and punk rock music, and kind of stayed in that on that road for most of my young life, and you know, pretty well in my adult life. As you know, I was the punk rock editor at Amazon.com. So well into my 30s, I was still bashing away at those three chords. But again, it was a house full of music. I absorbed my dad's record collection. My brother is also a fantastic guitar player. Like way better than I am. So it's always just been a part of my life.
Not to bury the lead here, but you were an early employee of Amazon. I met you in 1998 and, you know, you can picture it. People can picture in their head, like the typical overly cluttered offices with people working far too many hours. And you had like punk rock posters and guitars. Yours looked homey. So you've always had a bit of a guitar collection, right?
Yeah. So as soon as I could afford it, my first guitar was gifted to me by my parents. It's a Hondo Les Paul copy. I love that guitar. It's cheap, but I loved it. Scraped up money at the summertime job to buy an SG when I was in like a 1980 SG from the shop where I took music lessons. And then once I could afford it, I started collecting Gibsons. It was just a brand I really resonated with. I saw The Who in 1979 when Pete Townshend had those great, he had five Les Paul guitars numbered 1 through 5 and he'd play them through different songs. That was the coolest thing on the planet. So I started buying and then trading and selling Gibsons. My original idea for a collection was to collect 1964 Gibsons, which is the year I was born. But that was too hard and also very, very expensive. So I just started buying guitars that I loved and wanted to play. And then once I'd amass what would be too many, I'd trade some in or sell them and, you know, find another guitar that I was obsessed with. I tend to become obsessed with different guitars at different points. And I just sort of stock a guitar for 6 months to make sure it's the guitar I want and then try to find a source for it. And then I'll find another guitar and sometimes I'll sell the guitar that I was obsessed with and stock several years earlier, trade it in or sell it to buy the new guitar.
I love it. You were one of Amazon's first employees, and you didn't start out, obviously, as the punk rock editor. What was your role at Amazon, and when did you start?
So I was the 8th employee. I started as an operations manager, which is a really nice way of saying I worked in the warehouse. Back then, there was only, you know, a handful of us. And I met Jeff Bezos the first day, and we worked in this windowless warehouse underneath a color tile in South Seattle. And it was gruesome. You know, it was a very hard 12-hour physical day. And at the end of the day, when we get up against a deadline, Jeff Bezos, Mackenzie Bezos, and anyone that was working, you know, as a coder or programmer would come down to the basement. We'd all pack books together. Quickly, I mean, it was the fastest growing company of all time. So quickly went from being 8 employees to 50 to 100. I rose with the company. I knew I didn't want to be stuck in the warehouse as much as I enjoyed the work. So quickly tried to worm my way into editorial and just started spending my time after the warehouse wrapped up, going up to the editorial offices, scanning book covers and writing reviews, and became one of the original 3 editors. And then when they launched the music department, I was gung-ho. I couldn't wait. Working as a music editor at Amazon was a dream job. And for a while there, it really was. I mean, about the time you joined, we had a pretty a pretty amazing staff of people. I mean, from Mike McGonigal to you to Steve Stolder. I mean, just amazing people that have had really great experience in the music industry that we're looking at Amazon. It's probably one of the largest musical and most talented musical staffs, you know, ever assembled.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty magical. Going back, when you took that warehouse job, were you also looking at like other warehouse jobs that, you know, would have ended up going nowhere?
No, actually, I got my MFA in creative writing, and I hung out with a lot of writers, and a lot of my friends that were writers were working at Encarta. Probably none of your readers or your listeners know Encarta, but it was a online encyclopedia. No, it was actually a CD-ROM encyclopedia that Microsoft put out, and they all had pretty good gigs working there. So I went to a temp agency, took the test, hoping to get an Encarta gig. But I just wasn't very computer literate at the time, and I think I failed the computer test. And they sent me out to the store, to this place where I'd be packing books that were selling online. And I had a very vague concept of what the internet was at the time. So for me, it was kind of like a heart-sinking moment. It's like, wow, I can't even get on at Microsoft. But the first day at Amazon, I met Jeff, I met Tom Schoenoff, I met Newt Sears. Newt Sears is the guy, the programmer, who the movie War Games is based on. You know, he hacked the DoD when he was 15. Just these amazing people. Barry Trinkle, who was a rocket scientist, had won the Scripps Spelling Bee. I quickly realized, oh my God, these are amazing people, and this is something, this is a company that's going to go someplace special.
Yeah. And you were at Amazon, I mean, you were an early employee, so how many years all told were you there?
5 years total. I quit on my fifth anniversary. As you know, people probably don't remember, but right around 2001, the dot-com boom went bust, and things quickly evaporated. The Amazon stock price plummeted. Also, I was burned out. I'd worked so many of the 60 to 80 work weeks for so many years. I had just met my girlfriend, who is now my wife, and was definitely interested in having a life. So I quit in 2001. And I walked away satisfied that I had done a good job, and that for a while, for a long time at Amazon in the early days, especially, you felt like if you took a day off that the company would crash. And we all felt that way.
Yeah.
So it was nice to walk away and not feel that way. Just feel like they're going to be just fine without me. In fact, they're probably going to be better off.
Yeah. So fast forward, you move to the Central Coast of California. You start a family with Jen. You and I stay in touch. There are still guitars and music and all sorts of stuff in your life. And then your health kind of took a turn. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. Strangely enough, it came as a shock to me. I just started being short of breath and coughing, and it was starting to affect my life. So I went into the doctors and was quickly diagnosed with interstitial lung disease, which is really shocking because I never really smoked. I wasn't a coal miner. I didn't work around asbestos. All the indicators of lung disease weren't in my life. But I had this idiopathic lung disease that, you know, meant they didn't know the source of it. And it quickly degenerated. Within a couple of years, I was on oxygen. And that was difficult. Yeah. And then months later, found myself in the hospital, pretty much unable to breathe and unable to move. And then got on the list to get a lung transplant. And, you know, people can wait years for lungs, so it was a pretty grim future. The week I actually got my transplant, I didn't think I was going to make it to the end of the week.
Wow.
But they found some lungs through a donor. I'm fascinated with the donor process. I could talk about that forever. But
how does
donor.
That work? How do they fit you with somebody else? Is it like body size, body type, blood type?
Exactly. Body size is number one. They have to fit in your chest cavity. Number two is blood type. And then they have to test it for antibodies and all these things that can cause you to reject the lungs or cause the lungs to be rejected. You know, certain things in the lungs can cause your body to attack them. It's a real delicate balance. And there's also, it can't be, this is a difficult part of it. It has to be someone who's brain dead. They can't be dead. They have to be brain dead and on life support. And there's just, that just doesn't happen too often. And the most difficult part about that is that someone has to make a decision for that person to be taken off life support in order to transplant or to donate the organs for transplant. So somewhere out there is a family grieving that they've lost their kid and still making that entirely difficult decision to turn that opportunity, that into an opportunity for other people to improve the quality of their life. So it's a remarkable process. And then the surgery itself, I mean, it hasn't been around that long. I got my transplant at Stanford, which where the original lung transplant was in the 80s. So I think they've done 40,000 transplants since 1980.
Wow.
So they're getting better at it, and there's new technologies all the time. In fact, well, I'll begin this later, but I've had two transplants now. And just in the 3 years between transplants, the technology has changed quite a bit. So they're always developing new ways to do it. But to get back, I went into surgery Saturday night, woke up Sunday morning, they pulled a tube out of my mouth, and I could breathe. So it was a new lease on life. However, the rehabilitation is brutal. I mean, it's, you know, learning to walk again, learning to breathe again, learning to, there's a lot of medications you take with a transplant to keep your body from rejecting it, and they essentially shut down your immune system, so you live, I've been living like a COVID life for several years now, because I'm, you know, definitely afraid of infection, so, but eventually came around. After my first transplant, I became obsessed with the Gibson 339. it's a semi-hollow body, double cutaway guitar. I played one once years ago in Seattle. It was a magical guitar. So when you're recovering, you're in the hospital bed for hours, I mean all day, 24/7. So you look for things to entertain you, and one of the things that entertained me was online guitar shopping. So I found a nearby store that had a Gibson 339 that I wanted. And we had to move into an apartment next to Stanford so I could be close for 4 months after my transplant. And I got this guitar, and it was a big part of my rehabilitation, because transplant patients do better if they have a purpose-driven life. And, you know, laying around lamenting the fact that, you know, you've had a transplant doesn't cut it, but playing guitar and playing games and hanging with family or going back to work was really helpful. So I bought this guitar because I didn't have one with me up in the Bay Area, and I started playing, and I really fell in love with it. And I've always played. I've always kept up with my guitar work, but because I had so much time and I wasn't working, I really got to spend the hours to get to be in a better place. That led to my second transplant. I don't know if I'm talking too long.
No, keep going.
So eventually my body rejected my lungs, my first set of lungs, and again, quickly degraded. And I was hiking the day after Christmas, and by my birthday in February, I was back in the hospital with acute respiratory failure, and they didn't know what happened. It was COVID-like, but it wasn't COVID. Couldn't breathe. I was on oxygen. Had to be intubated, which means they push a tube down your throat and it does the breathing for you, in which case they induce a coma. So I was in a coma for about a month and a half, waiting for new lungs. It was delayed because there's other complications. I ended up having 15 surgeries, and they put me on something called ECMO, which is essentially dialysis for your organs and your heart. My doctor said I'm the only person he's ever heard of that survived two ECMOs, because I had to have two ECMOs to keep my oxygen level high in my body. But eventually they found a set of lungs. I was transplanted exactly 3 years to the date after my first transplant. Woke up, again the next day, and I could breathe. And, this time was a lot more difficult, because even though I could breathe because of complications, from the, you know, extended coma, the massive amounts of drugs they put you on, and the ECMOs, I was unable to walk. So I found myself in the hospital for much longer the second time than the first time. One of the concerns was that I had suffered a lot of cognitive loss from the coma. So I was unable to grip things. I was unable to write. I was unable to walk. I was unable. My speech was slurred. I forgot words. I couldn't finish sentences. So when I went to acute therapy, I worked with physical therapist, occupational therapist, and speech therapist. The speech therapist process is fascinating. So they really worked on my cognitive development and went from simple puzzles to gripping things to essentially doing the New York Times, you know, crossword daily, just this sort of process where you learn how to remember again and learn how to use your, you know, it just, luckily, for the most part, it came back for me. I still have large memory gaps, but they're coming back. And I really credit guitar playing with a big part of that. Right when we moved, actually, a good friend of mine, I think you know him, Phil Launcher, he's a guitarist for Whiskey Down and with Jesse Sykes. He found a Gibson, oh God, what was it? It's a 1970 Gibson J160E, which is the John Lennon guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And he found one at a an estate sale, and he fixed it up, and I convinced him to sell it to me. So I had this guitar the day I got out of the hospital and moved into this apartment. And it was really distressing because I couldn't even play a chord. My hands just didn't grip it right. It just hurt. I couldn't remember songs. I couldn't remember chords. So I just kept at it and started with simple chord D, C, G's. And my daughter hung out with me a lot. She's a big music fan and an excellent piano player. And she played me some music just she liked. And I learned songs for her to play her and learned songs for my wife to play her and try to remember some of the songs that I knew how to play. And really, it was really fun. It was a big part of my rehab. And also just, you know, I couldn't walk very well at the time, so I was stuck a lot. So while I was learning to walk again, I was also learning to play guitar. I think it really helped my cognitive rebound. And then one day we got out of the hospital, or out of the apartment, and we went to Guitar Center. And my brother had just bought a Guild guitar that he loved. It was the M240. It's the they call the Nick Drake guitar.
Yeah.
Not all of my guitars have names from famous musicians, but these two do. And he loved it. He was raving about it. And I found one at the Guitar Center. And my wife's like, just buy it. I'm like, well, I just bought a guitar. She's like, listen, just buy it. And this guitar changed the way I play. It's one of my first non-Gibsons with the Guild. It's meant to be strummed and picked. And like I said before, as a punk rocker, I bash and thrash. I don't strum and pick. But this guitar almost demanded it. Almost like, so I started playing a much different set of songs than I had before. I was looking for prettier songs, delicate songs, songs that can be picked, and really fell in love with that side of music. And I started searching for more songs that fell into this category. And I wasn't even sure what the category was. It was just songs that evoked something in my head, some kind of beauty or loveliness or sadness. So this guitar was just suited to it. So I just began, I spend my days with this guitar in my lap, you know, and just picking and writing songs. And then I started doing covers and started to discover. There's a few songs that really spoke to me, that sort of that steered me in a certain direction. And then because I was spending so much time and learning so much many new songs, I decided, and then the result of that, probably because of my cognitive decline, I started forgetting the songs that I'd learned. So I wanted to start cataloging them. And that led me to the idea of learning a song a day.
Yeah.
And I set myself a goal of learning a song a day for a year, which seemed really easy and brilliant at first. And now it's really a challenge, but it's something I definitely want to take on. And it's led me into some music that maybe I wouldn't have heard or listened to before, and definitely not have learned how to play.
Now, when you posted about this 4 or 5 days ago, that was when I reached out to you and said, Tom, yeah. you got to be on the Fretboard Journal podcast, because I looked at this list and it's, you know, everything from Nick Drake to Spiritualized and Love, and, you know, it's the full gamut of all yeah. the different styles yeah. of music. You outlined some classic rock. So what day are you on now, and what was today's song?
Today's song is, let me find it. I've been lurking on it right now again. Oh, Dark Globe by Syd Barrett.
Okay.
And that is officially my 59th song. However, there are some songs on here that are still in development. So what I want to do is I'm going to start posting daily the song of the day and make that my official song of the day. I'll probably backlog it a bit, because I have accomplished about 2 months worth of songs so far. But with this purpose driven, you know, I'm going to make a list. I'm going to commit to it. I'm going to share these songs with people. That's going to be the next, I guess it's the step of accountability, because I can say I learned a song a day, but unless I actually say what that song is and share it, it doesn't really count.
Yeah. Now I'm going to open the floodgates here and say that if anybody wants to offer suggestions for the other 300-plus songs you should do, you can email us. I'll have them email me so you're not flooded with these. I'll compile them for you.
Okay.
Podcast at fretboardjournal.com. I'll also include a link to your Spotify playlist so people can get a sense of the kind of stuff you're listening to. I'm just curious, what's your process like when you decide to tackle a song? Like, what are your first steps?
First step is to listen to the song. You know, a lot of them I come to me or a friend suggests it. I give it a listen. I see if it's something that I think I can play. Oftentimes I'm like, oh God, I'm lost. But it's been interesting. My daughter has challenged me to play some songs that I thought were beyond my skill set. And sitting down and learning those songs has actually expanded my skill set. So I'm not backing away from many songs. Someone did suggest to me this Dark Globe by Syd Barrett. I listened to it, I immediately was like, there's no way. There's no way. But then the more I listened to it, the more I realized it's a fairly simple song. Syd Barrett just makes it really complicated because he's out of tune and his singing style sort of runs counter to what the chords are doing. And then if I'm not successful in doing it by ear, I don't have a very good ear, I go to Guitar Cats. And see what other people have done. And I also, I don't read music. And even the tabs can be difficult for me, especially given some of my cognitive abilities. So sometimes the chord diagrams definitely help. And then there's videos on Guitar Tabs, Ultimate Guitar Tabs, I should give a call out, of other people who are just as bad as me learning to play the song. And that's really helpful to watch them do it. And also, I'm inspired by their bravery for actually posting a video of themselves playing the song, not always well. Yeah. So through that, through those processes, some of the songs too are songs that I learned from my dad back in the day that I haven't played in years. I'm going to start doing some Buddy Holly songs, which I haven't played probably since I was 15. And songs that I loved in, you know, the 80s when I had a band in college and things like that. So some of the songs are definitely familiar to me, but I am learning how to play them again.
And have you missed a day?
I have not missed a day. There's been days where at the end of the day, I'm ready to go to bed and I'm like, oh shit, I haven't learned a song. I do have a list of songs that are sort of like in my back pocket that I know I can play or am interested in playing. So I can go check that list and, you know, fairly learn it quickly. I love this book when I was growing up called How to Eat 50 Fried Worms. The kid had to eat a worm a day. And then one day he forgets and he goes out into the yard and he digs up a worm and he eats it dirt and all. And there's been a couple nights like that where I was like, oh no, I have to go dig up a worm really quick. And, you know, just get on to my library on Spotify or iTunes and just search around for something I think I can learn. And then put it together. Not always, the retention's not always great. I'm still, one of my challenges definitely is remembering lyrics. So I can say that of the songs that I've learned so far, maybe half I know the lyrics through all the way. The other ones I still am learning the lyrics too.
Yeah. And I'm not going to ask you to share any of these, but are you recording each of these, or is it just like, hey, I did it, I'm moving on to the next one?
I did it, and I play it for my family, and that's the validation I'm getting right now. Yeah. But I do want to start recording them. I think it's pretty cowardly not to record them. I'm not the most talented guitarist. I was actually joking with you earlier, and my wife, I'm like, I'm probably the worst guitarist who ever appeared on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
<It's okay.
laughs> And you post those, and then you're open to criticism. But I think, being open and saying I'm not the best guitarist, and I'm a horrible singer, though I love to sing. I just learned PJ Harvey's song. Let me see what it is. But she just wails in it, just wails in. I love wailing along to that song. Oh, Good Fortune by PJ Harvey. It's driving my family crazy, but it doesn't stop me from singing it. So I do want to bite the bullet and start playing the songs and singing them, on recording. But it would be, I don't have a recording studio or anything like that, so it definitely just be amateur recordings on my phone. But I do, that is a goal of mine.
I love it. Is there one, is it the Guild that you use for all of these, or do you mix it up? You have quite a guitar collection.
Yeah, so the other weird thing that happened to me recently is I broke my leg.
I know.
On top of everything.
The shittiest few years anyone could ask for.
Yeah, so one of the side effects of one of the drugs I take is really weak bones. And I took a very minor fall and did a spiral fracture to my tibia, which means I can't put weight on it, which means I'm either in a wheelchair or on the couch, which actually facilitates learning songs. Yeah. It's actually been a weird blessing in disguise because now I have hours to play music without thinking about it. So I'm stuck upstairs in my living room. My studio is downstairs. I can't get up and down the stairs. So my fairly large guitar collection, amps and pedals, are all down there. So I have the two guitars I've discussed up here. I have the Guild and my 339. And those are the most, I'd say 80% I'm playing on the Guild. The 339 is a little easier to play for some songs that require a little more complicated fretwork. It's got a beautiful neck, beautiful soft, fast action neck. So some songs are easier on that. But because of the style of songs I'm playing, the Guild is typically the go-to guitar for these.
You mentioned the Syd Barrett song. Are there other Mount Everests on your horizon that you know you'll eventually have to tackle?
Well, the first Mount Everest for me was Alone Again Or by Love, which is probably my favorite song of all time.
Yeah.
It's multi-genre. it's got some Spanish guitar in it, and it's got a fairly complicated introduction, chords I've never played before. It's simple over time, but at first glance, it's very difficult for me, at least. When my daughter first said, why aren't you playing this song? I just said, oh, it's too hard. I can't do that. But then I just sat with it for a few days, and it's probably the song I play the most. I'm still working on it. I'm still trying to get the intro down. But I've got the lyrics down. I've got the chord progression down. The other thing I try to do, probably because I'm not a great guitarist, is that I sort of adapt it to my own abilities. So I'm not in any way trying to make a note-for-note perfect rendition of a song on the record. I'm trying to make it something that I can play and sing and make it my own. So I've done that a little bit with that song. What's the other one? Just looking at the list now. Oh, the two Fred Neil songs, Everybody's Talking and the Dolphins, were difficult for me to learn because of the cadence. Fairly simple in terms of the chords, but he has just this cadence that just it sort of like runs over the music, and I've made it a little bit myself, but I'm also trying to be faithful to the songs that he wrote. And surprisingly to me is how difficult some of the David Bowie songs are. I always thought that David Bowie's theme, three chord rocker, but he throws some interesting chords into the mix. And he uses often chords somewhat as a melodic component. So he's changing chords quickly to go along with the melody, totally, as opposed to having a melody to be flowed over the chords. And that can be a challenge for me. The big surprise in the other direction is my wife. I found out after we were married that my wife was a bit of a deadhead. That was kind of a deal killer for me, but she never shared that with me. But through osmosis, and also my daughter listens to a ton of music, and she's kind of fallen in love with the Dead as well. I found some Dead songs that I actually love, and or covers. Mostly I love their covers. So I started challenging, I thought it would be challenging myself to learn Dead songs. But those guys, man, they play two chords or three chords at best. So they've been really easy songs to learn. Of course, I'm not jamming on top of them. But there's some really beautiful, elegant songs they play, and they're super simple to play.
I wish I could go back in time and talk to the Todd Nelson I knew in 1998 and tell him that he's about to learn some Dead songs.
I had a moment. I was up here learning how to play Franklin's Tower, and I heard my daughter, she's cleaning her bedroom downstairs, and she's just cranking the Clash, just as loud as it can go. I thought, something is wrong here. Something is dead wrong, because Clash is always one of my all-time favorite bands, and here's my daughter listening to Clash, and I'm up here learning a Dead song. So it was a little bit of a humiliating come down for me.
Yeah. Well, I love this project. I'm gonna give you, like I said, folks are gonna hopefully bury you with song suggestions, and I'm gonna give you an open invite. If you want to come back when you hit song 100 or whatever, I want follow ups. I think people do. I got to ask before I let you go, what guitar are you obsessing over now? It sounds like you've always got one in your sights.
So there's two I'm gonna mention. One is one that I own. My first guitar is an SG Artist R1. It's this really weird guitar. It's the only one I could afford. It has a Moog soundboard in it. And they only made 200 of them. And it's either worthless or priceless. I don't know. But the Moog board has gone bad, so I'm working really hard. I've just replaced the tuning pegs. I'm trying to sort of restore it to what it was originally. And I'm falling in love with it again. And I found an online community of people that are also obsessed with this guitar. Of the 200 sold, we've tracked down 73 people who own them.
Wow.
So, yeah, and they're also all sort of obsessed about it. So that's one. And then I have a Les Paul, a 1963 Les Paul Junior. And I'm actually thinking of getting a newer one. It's one of my most playable guitars, but it's old. And I'd like one that... I know Gibson has gone up and down through the years, but I think there's a few years later on where they built some nice guitars, and I'd like to go acquire another one of those.
I love it. Todd, yeah. Take care. This was great. You did it. I love sharing your story, and I'm rooting for you.
Thank you very much, Jason. And I just want to say, we didn't get to talk much about the Amazon days, but working with you is a pleasure. You're one of the best people I worked with. You brought joy to the office. You brought knowledge to the table. It was really awesome. And it's really great to see you build on that with the amazing magazine you developed. And I know so many people, virtually every guitarist I know is a big fan of what you're doing. So congratulations to you.
Thank you, Todd. That was my conversation with Todd Nelson. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, our music is by John Rauhaus. Martin Guitars and Calton Cases sponsor all the stuff that we do. Please go check their stuff out. And if you like the podcast, leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts and be sure to share it with your friends.